Sunday in our series, Who Do We Think We Are? Has anybody ever watched that program, Who Do You Think You Are? Where they take a celebrity and they go back and dig through their back through their family tree and they find out all the interesting and scandalous and other things about that. Or they find out, you know, the actor finds that their great-grandfather was an actor as well, and all those sorts of things that tend to happen in family trees. Well, we've been spending last week and this week and also next week, we're going to be looking at some aspects of our family tree, if you like, going back over the last 2,000 years, because often we look at Old Testament history, you know, what happened to the children of Israel, and we look at what happened in the time of Jesus, and then it was sort of a big leap to just us today. But there actually is 2,000 years of stuff that have happened in between. We're going to start just by rereading a couple of passages that Mia referred to last week. And the first one is from Acts chapter 2, beginning in verse 42. And it's talking about the group of believers. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their houses and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favour of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. And the second passage was Hebrews chapters 11 and beginning of chapter 12. And we're not going to read all of it, but chapter 11 goes through and talks about how by faith so many people did things, whether it's Abel being a better offering to God, whether it's Enoch walking with God, whether it's Abraham leaving his country and going to the country that God would show him, whether it's Moses, Jacob and Isaac and Joseph and Moses all trusting God and doing things as a result of that, marching around Jericho and seeing the walls fall, whether it's Gideon or Barak or Samson or King David or Samuel or the prophets or whoever, people who trusted God. And then there's a whole bunch of list of other names of people who trusted God as well through difficult times and were tortured and killed unjustly and all those sorts of things. And it says they were looking for something better. They were looking for something better with us. It says in the end of chapter 11, these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. And they are people who are in the great cloud of witnesses waiting for us to finish our races, so that together with them we may enter into the glory that God has for all of us. And I'm sure that some of those cloud of witnesses are those that have run their race in the last 2,000 years. Now, there's lots and lots of stories from Christian history we could pick out. And I'm just going to try and trace a line today through some interesting people that hopefully will connect all the way to us today. And the first people I want to talk about are two interesting characters. Thanks, Ian, if you can put up the next one. A guy called Cyril, maybe with a bit of a Cyril happening. That's right. I wish I could do that. Cyril and Methodius. Cyril and Methodius. Now, these guys were brothers, and they were born in about 820. And I should actually back up a bit, because Christianity sort of bubbled up from underneath, right? When Jesus was ascended back to heaven, there was only 120 followers, and they weren't in positions of power or authority. And over the next 300 years, the life of Christians was so captivating that by the early 300s, over 50% of the Roman Empire were Christians. And so Christianity was almost they had to recognize that, and it was allowed to become a legal religion. And then it became the religion of the Roman Empire. And from a bottom-up movement, it now became a top-down movement. And then the Roman Empire declined, and those of you who remember your history, it sort of split into two halves. You had the Byzantium Empire in the east and the remnants of the Roman Empire in the west, and there was similar sort of alignments of bishops, and political and religious authorities were sort of aligned. And these two guys, Cyril and Methodius, were from the Byzantine side of the Christian world of the empire, and they were sort of in modern day Turkey. Now there was a kingdom up in what's today the Czech Republic, and they decided that they needed to the king decided he needed to have his people evangelized. So he invited the Christian powers that be down in Constantinople to send some people up to evangelize his people, very top down. And so these are the two guys that were chosen, Cyril and Methodius. And I don't know about you, but not very many people who get to create an alphabet. But Cyril did. You see, because we had Latin spoken in the West in Italy and Greek mainly spoken in the East, but in this kingdom that they're going to, in what's now the Czech Republic, it was Slavic. And there were sounds in the Slavic language that couldn't be represented by either the Greek or the Roman alphabets. So they had to sort of make a new alphabet, not entirely new, but a new alphabet with new symbols for the different sounds that were in that language. And so Cyril did that because what they were doing was translating the Bible and the liturgy into the local language. So that's Cyril and Methodius. And you can read more about it on Wikipedia, but then there was this sort of back and forth because there was battles about, can you have, you know, if you're going to be, connected with all the other churches, your liturgies, that maybe they should be in Latin, or you're supposed to be in Latin. And so Cyril and Methodius ended up going to Rome and meeting the Pope and having all these sorts of negotiations and backs and forth and everything else. But the critical thing was that they came to this area, it's what's called the Czech Republic today, and they started to translate the liturgy and the scriptures into the local dialect, into the local language, so that people could understand it. And that was quite successful. But now we need to jump about 500 years further forward, thanks Ian, to a guy called Jan. And he was born in the middle of the 14th century, I think 1369, and then he was burned at the stake in 1415 because of his religious views. That's what sort of happens when religious and political power sometimes get together, and when you have sharp differences of opinion, if you're considered to be a heretic by the church, then the church decided that Jan was a heretic, so they handed him over to the earthly powers and they burned him at the stake. Now the interesting thing is that Jan was sort of like a predecessor to Martin Luther. Martin Luther lived about 100 years later. But this guy, he was saying, no, the people in the church, they should get both the bread and the wine, not just the bread and leave the wine for all the priests to drink. He was saying that the liturgy should be in the local language. Interesting that, isn't it? Because of the history of the area, and guys Cyril and Methodius had sort of planted the seed for that hundreds of years before. And other things like they were against the selling of indulgences and things like that Luther also disagreed with later on. And so he was a lecturer in the local university in the area, and as I said, the church convicted him of heresy and he got burned at the stake. But about 30 years later, groups of people said, we want to take this following Jesus seriously. They were sort of followers of Jan Hus was his last name, and they took the name Hussites or Hussites. And there was actually some sort of civil war broke out. People were really intense about their religion at this particular time, and there was different people had fights about different things, but there was this one group of people who said, no, we are going to, the important thing is not what you say you believe, but the way you act. And they said, we're going to take the Sermon on the Mount seriously. We're not going to take swear oaths. And it's about living out the ethic of Jesus as taught in the Sermon on the Mount. And they formed together a Christian community which they called the Unitas Fratrum, or the Brotherhood. The Unity of the Brethren. And this started in 1457. And that so permeated the area, this sort of early Protestant movement, that within the next 70 years, it had basically permeated the whole kingdom. There wasn't a town without a Protestant school. Lots of the nobles and all those sorts of people were Protestant, and they were taking it seriously, that you don't just have to sort of give mental assent to these things and follow the outward rituals, but you needed to be a person who lived out the teachings of Jesus. But then as things happen, some emperor wangled something and they installed a Catholic king in this area of what is modern day Czech Republic. And so that put all of the Protestant nobles in difficult positions. You either become Catholic or you fight. And so terrible war broke out, and the war went on for 30 years. The population plummeted from 3 million to 800,000. And then eventually these small bands of Unitas Fratrum, the unity of the brethren, even they had to sort of were exiled, and some moved to Poland, some moved to the lowlands. Others basically went into secret and hiding. And they passed on their teaching and their way of living secretly from generation to generation. Now we need to jump to the next slide again, because I just want to talk to you about a guy called Nick. So he was born in 1700. And he was born into a wealthy family, a landed family, a noble family. But his dad died when he was young, and his mum then remarried, and he was then raised by his pietistic grandmother. Now, pietism was a thing that had sort of stemmed out of Lutheranism. We talked about Martin Luther earlier. And they were also people who took living a Christian life seriously. It wasn't just about the rituals, but it was about your character. It's about what you did. And this young guy called Nick, he was a person that was captivated by Jesus, and he would write letters to Jesus, and telling Jesus, when he was 6 years old, he'd write letters to Jesus telling him how much he loved him. And he would sort of throw them out the window of the upper room in the castle where he was living, and they would sort of flutter down to the ground below. Some soldiers came from Sweden and overran the area, and they burst into the room and they found him there praying, and they were deeply impressed by this young person's devotion. Again, you may have heard about all, you know, sort of the noble and wealthy people. What they did is that they went on grand tours. When Top Gear finished, the guys, they went over to Amazon and they did a car program called the Grand Tour. Well, the wealthy nobles, one of the sort of rites of passage was that when you got to 16 or whatever, you would do a tour of the main capitals of Europe, and you'd expose yourself to the art and the architecture and the building. So, I mean, many people today sort of go overseas, don't they, when they've got a gap year or whatever else. A bit like that. So this guy, Nick, was 16 when he did that, and he was just about to enter into university to study law. And he's going around, and he sees in one of the art galleries somewhere, I think it might have been in Dusseldorf, this next painting. And it's a bit hard for you to see, but it's on the left-hand side, but it's a painting that was painted by many top artists in many ways, but it was called, the Latin is Ecce Homo, behold the man. And it's after Pilate has scourged and had Jesus scourged and whipped and the crown on his head, and then he's presented before the people, and Pilate says, behold the man. And when this earnest young man, Nick, came and saw this painting, he had an encounter with God. I think it was not just the painting, but it was the inscription below the painting which is Jesus saying, this is what I've done for you, what are you going to do for me? I gave my life, I suffered, I died for you. What are you going to do to me? And the Spirit of God touched Nick right at that moment. And he confessed, I've loved God, but I've not done anything for God. And so he got together with a few of his rich mates, and they set up a printing press, and they started printing cheap Bibles and tracts and other things and distributing them around the place. He decided that what he would do is he would buy, a few years later, that he would buy some land, because that's what landowners did. He bought some off a grandmother or something like that. And that he would not just sort of be like the lord of the manor and lord it over people, but that he would invest his life in the tenants that lived on that place. He wasn't just going to be a rich person that lived a nice, comfortable life, but he was going to do something about it. This is all when he's 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. So that's Nick. Thanks, Ian. So Nick bought this place, the next one, thanks Ian, off his grandmother, a place called, Bethelsdorf. And this is where it connects to where we left off before with that group of people that had been scattered because of persecution. Some of them got tired of living the secret life in the Czech Republic and they migrated north. And they ended up at this place, Bethelsdorf. Is that how you pronounce it? Yeah. Bethelsdorf, yeah. And Nick, wanting to live a vigorous Christian life, he said, he said, well, you can establish a little village on my place. And so these exiles, these persecuted remnant of this Protestant movement that had sprung up centuries before, were then allowed to gather. And from 1722, they started to gather in this place and in this village. But, you know, when you've been under persecution and things like that, people have really strong ideas about what's the true truth and all that sort of stuff. And by 1727, this small little village was wracked by religious arguments and disagreements. They even got to the point where they thought that some of them were preaching that Nick, the landowner who had given them the land to live on, the sanctuary where they could live, some of them were calling him the beast of the apocalypse. You know, picking out, you know, some terrible person from the book of Revelation saying, well, Nick's that guy. Of course he wasn't, but you can see the sort of arguments and tensions that might have been going on there. And so this is in 1727, and so Nick left his job as an ambassadorial sort of role and came back to his landholding and needed to sort this out. And what he did was he went from house to house and he prayed with the people in this house. And then he went to the next house and he prayed with the people in this house. You've got to remember, he's only 27 at this point, right? And then he called them together and they studied the scriptures together. And they tried to figure out and what to do. And they really asked the deep question, how do we live in Christian community? And they were studying the Bible from this point of view. How do you live in Christian community? And then they drew up a rule of life. A bit like monasteries do, a bit like monks do, and Mia talked about them last week. You know, they agree together how they are going to live. And on the 12th of May 1727, these guys had agreed and they just all signed up to this covenant, this way that they were going to live together. Nick and them did a bit more explaining and exploring, and they discovered remarkable similarities between what they had agreed and what those Hussites hundreds of years before had also agreed about their way they were going to live. The sort of spiritual heritage had come down from them to this group. A couple of months later, they were in the church in Bethelsdorf on the 13th of August, 1727, and there was a visitation of the Spirit of God. And God did a deep work in their lives, an amazing work in their lives. So much so that it sparked something. And there was a continuous prayer meeting that went for 100 years from that day. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They were committed to living life together. They figured out ways to do it together. They were serious about living vigorous Christian lives, about being formed in their character and learning how to live in Christian community. And they went out in mission. They were some of the first people to send out non-ordained missionaries, lay people, not ordinary people, to go and do mission. And many of them would go and do mission and they would die on the mission field. They paid big prices, but they were glad to go because of the work that God had done in their hearts. Now I want to tell you about another guy called John. He was born a few years later than Nick in 1703. And he had a godly mother who raised him and his siblings really well. And he became a minister in the Anglican Church. And he was determined to try and do reform and to, again, have people live in holiness and to live out a Christian life. And he decided, I need to go to America. And so he jumps on a boat to go to America. And he sees some of these people from this place in Germany, and he sees them on the boat. And he's impressed by them. He's impressed by their humility. They would just get around and they would do all the menial tasks on the boat that nobody else wanted to do. And then at one point, there was this massive storm. And, you know, waves crashing over the boat, and all the Englishmen are screaming and they're going, oh, we're going to die, we're going to die. And these group of Germans, they're just there calmly singing a hymn. And John said, those guys have got something. I don't know what it is, but those guys have got something. Anyway, they get to America safely. The storm didn't sink the boat. And John has a go at trying to do some mission in America, and he fails dismally. He wanders back to England with his tail between his legs. And after much persuading for some of his friends, he goes and meets some of these Germans that were living and meeting in London. And at that meeting, God did something in his heart. God changed his heart and lit a fire in him. Some of the what had been poured out at Bethelsdorf was then poured out into John and changed. He ended up visiting Bethelsdorf and he met Nick, and they had conversations about stuff, and he learnt from them about how they did things with small groups, and he went back to England, and he was maybe single-handedly one of the guys that was responsible for avoiding a revolution in England. They had a bottom-up movement where ordinary people from all over the country, from all walks of life, became followers of Jesus, and their lives were reformed, and the way they lived changed, the way they raised their families changed, the way they worked changed, the way they invested in people and did good to those around them changed. And these people are connected to us. How is that so? Well, the Nick that I told you about, his full name is Count Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf. And you might better know the place rather than Bethelsdorf. You may have heard of the village that was on the estate of Bethelsdorf called Herrnhut. And you may have heard of the name of the church and the movement that was birthed in that place. It was the Moravians. Because the kingdom back in what is now the Czech Republic, that was the kingdom of Moravia. It wasn't Moravia where they were in Saxony in Germany. But that denomination exists to this day. And if you've got our Bible reading app, we read Moravian texts every day. And the John, well, you probably know him better as John Wesley. And it was at Aldersgate where he went to a Moravian gathering and he recorded that his heart was strangely warmed. And he learned from the Moravians the vital importance of small groups where they were accountable. They arranged their small groups in the Moravians by age and gender and life stage, whether you're young or old, male or female or whatever else. And it was almost regimented. We wouldn't do small groups that way today. But John learned from them, and so he created Methodist classes where people would come together every week and ask each other, how is it with your soul? How are you going with God? And 12 years and 1 month ago, I went to Coorong and came across 3DM stuff. And we've been having a crack at doing that ever since. And 3DM is inspired by John Wesley and the Moravians. We do small group huddles where we say, what's God saying to us and what are we doing about it? We read daily texts just like the Moravians. We try and figure out ways to do Christian community together. And we're also committed to local mission. A bottom-up, bubbling-up movement, not a top-down, power-driven movement. And so you and I can draw a line from Cyril through Jan and Nick and John to today. It seems that as we trace this movement all the way back from Acts chapter 2, there are three elements to that seems to keep renewing time and time again. And if you can put the last line up, is that these people, whether they were the first believers or the Hussites or the Moravians or the Wesleyans or those in St. Thomas in Sheffield, and hopefully in us, are committed to a passionate spirituality, a radical community, and a missionary zeal. So when we look back in our Christian family tree, that's what we see. That's what I want to live. I hope that's what you want to live out too. A passionate spirituality, a radical community, and a missional zeal. You see, Christianity is losing its top-down privilege in our society. The answer is not to fight to get it back. The answer is a bottom-up, bubbling up of ordinary, nameless people in small gatherings here, there and everywhere, like you and me, like this little church, like other little churches, like other unknown gatherings, where people say, yes, we want to live a vigorous Christian life. We want to take the teachings of Jesus seriously. We want to work out what it is to follow Jesus in community. We're committed to God. We're prayerful. We're Bible studying. We're worshipping people. We're people who live together in community, where it's better to be part of community than not part of community. And we're committed to serving and reaching out to those around us, giving them compelling examples of what it is like to follow Jesus and the glory of Jesus. And just as it has happened in numerous times in history in the past, maybe we can be part of a bubbling up that changes our culture. Let's pray. God, we thank you that there are people who have gone before us, who are examples to inspire and challenge us, who have wisdom to pass on to us. Lord, may their legacy inspire us. May your life inspire us to lives of passionate spirituality, radical community, and missionary zeal. In Jesus' name, Amen.